This was Illinois primary week, and for some contests, the most high-profile ones, it's not yet over. This weekend, we look back at what happened and ahead at what's next. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. Even if voter turnout is low, and maybe even because of it, there are things we can learn from even primary elections when the races that matter most have already been decided. We're going to look at some of the results and the outlook during this half hour with two stellar journalists. I am joined by political analyst Mike Flannery, most recently on the air at Fox 32, and he was our partner last Tuesday during our Election Central coverage. And we are joined by A.D. Quigg, who covers city and state government and politics for the Chicago Tribune and is one of my closest cohorts here at the at City Hall's press room. We are conducting this conversation via Zoom conferencing, and thanks to you both. Let's start with the state's attorney's race, because that was that race to replace Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox was the marquee matchup Tuesday. Clayton Harris III came in with the County Democratic Party's endorsement, with a campaigning County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, the party chair, and others. But former appellate judge Eileen O'Neill Burke came in with a lot of money and support from some conservatives and business people, and the race is still too close to call. As we are recording this on Friday, Mike Flannery, what's going on here?
Well, Eileen O'Neill Burke, Craig, as a number of people remarked on, did not really run a full-throated attack campaign against the incumbent, Kim Fox. And Ms. Fox, a couple of days after the election this past week, made the point that as close as it is, there's not a mandate to change her policies. I think she can make that argument. I think there's something to that argument. O'Neill Burke seemed to campaign arguing that, yeah, I'm going to keep some of the initiatives that Kim Fox has put in place, restorative justice and some other things, but I'm going to be a little bit tougher on gun crimes and some other offenses than she has been. And right now, as we record this, she's got a lead. I think I'd prefer to be her at this point than Clayton Harris III.
Indeed. But A.D., Tony Preckwinkle was invested in this race. I've heard some complaints that maybe she wasn't as full-throated as she might have been. But from your perspective in covering the county, how do you see her influence and what this means?
It's given how close it is right now, it's kind of tough to call. And given that this was such a low turnout election, it's also kind of tough to call. It's hard to make kind of blanket assessments when like Democrats aren't as excited as they could be at the top of the ticket. Like Joe Biden's already decided, people weren't turning out as much. And the other thing we have to keep in mind, as much as we like talking about like the old days of the Cook County Democratic Party, it's not like a patronage system where members are getting rewards anymore and sent out door to door to go knock for people results in kind of a reward. The reason people are involved with the party now is to kind of be in the mix, get an endorsement, get a party-wide mailer sent out. And the benefit proposition is not the same as it was. So I think anyone would kind of struggle to force party folks to turn out. I would say Preckwinkle was as aggressive on the campaign trail as I've ever seen her for Clayton Harris. But this race did not get a ton of coverage. I can tell you, I was at like a lot of state's attorney candidate events where I was the only reporter there asking questions. And at a lot of those events, Tony Preckwinkle was there saying, Clayton Harris is our guy. He's important to continuing on this criminal justice reform movement that I am very invested in. I think she thinks of this as part of her lasting legacy. But yeah, the party is not what it used to be, where they can have hundreds of people out door knocking and getting a reward for it. So the math is a little bit different, but I am curious at the end of the day, when all the results are finally tallied, people see this as a referendum of her leadership and if she could have been more creative getting more people out to the polls, and if she could have done a better job fighting back against all of the funding that Eileen O'Neill Burke got.
Well, AD and Craig, if I could just jump in. I mean, one of the things that struck me when I watched this campaign unfold was Clayton Harris III and Tony Preckwinkle. I mean, they were at a news conference with Reverend Jesse Jackson a few days before the election, you know, and doing what they had been doing all, you know, for months, all but calling Eileen O'Neill Burke a racist based on a case that unfolded 30 years ago. It struck me that that just fell flat. I think, you know, that's kind of been that was really the heart of their attacks on her. And it didn't work.
I think that you're right about that, that it was because she could say it was 30 years ago and that she had never been cited as making a bad move. In fact, it was the lawyer for the young man who was sent to jail unjustly, who should have challenged the confession that he supposedly made. But I thought one of the other issues here is that we were dealing with two unknown quantities. Neither one of these people had ever run for elective office before. They were virtually unknown ahead of the campaign. So these campaigns were building them from scratch. And I think, AD, their positions for all the rhetoric within the campaigns and the ads, they weren't all that far apart.
Right, right. And I will say Eileen O'Neill Burke ran for judge, but as we know, judge is not like a super sexy,
exactly,
high attention race. The other thing I think we have to keep in mind is that there was not an animating event like Laquan McDonald pushing people to the polls. That really got people invested and understanding what an important role the state's attorney's office has in prosecuting crime in general. So there was not like a certain level of excitement. The other thing is that neither of these candidates had as compelling of a story or presentation as Kim Fox did when she first came on the scene. I think Kim Fox was able to really leverage her personal story growing up in Cabrini, and serving as a prosecutor. Kind of, we saw Clayton Harris kind of allude to this, being like, I was a Black man prosecuting other Black men, and I also live in a neighborhood where I worry about violent crime. But it just didn't register in the same way that Kim did forever ago. And Craig, you're right, they were not far apart on a lot of issues. The main contention that Eileen O'Neill Burke made was, if you liked the job that Kim Fox is doing, don't vote for me. That was kind of the main thrust. And that she would be much more public about the importance of pushing back on crime and unilaterally asking for detention on a certain number of violent crimes. It was like slightly more tough on crime, but we want to keep a lot of the things that Kim wants to do. And the only animating issue from the other side, Mike, you're right, was that old case from 30 years ago. And to go back to Craig's comments, that boy never went to jail. He was sentenced to probation, which was essentially sent back to his family, which is another point Eileen O'Neill Burke made. This was not a wrongful conviction where someone spent decades in jail.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, there was a short sentence, and he served it within 5 years.
And we should, before we leave the county stuff, for Tony Preckwinkle did manage to force out Circuit Court Clerk Iris Martinez by backing Mariana Spiropoulos, although you can also question whether the victory was Tony's or the fact that Mariana Spiropoulos was able to hugely bankroll her campaign all on her own, pretty much, and that she was a forceful campaigner all by herself.
And she had the backing of the new political army, the Chicago Teachers Union and their progressive allies, who on election day, as I understand it, covered thousands of precincts, certainly hundreds of precincts in the city and in the suburbs.
Yeah, that. But there was bad blood between Iris Martinez and Tony Preckwinkle going back to her Martinez's original election, when she also didn't have the party backing, but overcame it. But overcame it with a strong Latino vote, which again, lack of excitement, low turnout, wasn't there.
Yeah, certainly the defeat of Martinez, and it was a large margin by which she was defeated, certainly calls into question her whole approach to the past 4 years. She and Spiropoulos got into it, but there continue to be problems in that circuit court clerk's office. Not that that was a deciding factor in any way, but it's let's hope that Spiropoulos gets in there and fixes the computers, gets the documents available for the courts and for the lawyers and for members of the public who want the documents. It continues to be a mess over there.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I'll say about the Martinez race is Iris Martinez also lost her own home ward in the committeeman's race. Where she's at on the northwest side, Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez's kind of core progressive district, that whole area had a ton of activity that I think worked against Iris exactly where her base was.
Mm-hmm. But as we leave the Iris Martinez loss, I do want to say we should do remember where she started from as far as what that office was like. At the time that she took over, they used carbon paper.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they were actually using computers, admittedly with some glitches, that was a huge change.
Let's give her credit for that. Dorothy Brown for years had claimed that she was bringing it up to the Harvard Business School standards. That's just comical.
Yeah, they were still buying carbon paper. But let's talk about the other marquee race, and that was Bring Chicago Home. Again, hasn't been decided yet. We're still seeing votes come in, and we know we're going to see a bunch of votes come in after our taping. But I will tell you, when I looked at the numbers with 89%, I think of the votes, or 87 or 89% of the votes counted, and it looks like they're far apart, because it's 53% no votes for Bring Chicago Home and 46%. Yes. However, in raw numbers, there were 22,500 votes between the no's and the yeses. That's not a lot, but that's what happens when you have low turnout, that there just aren't that many votes.
Mayor Johnson won with 28,000 votes, with a much bigger turnout than we got the other day. A win's a win, a loss is a loss.
Yeah, but still, this is again something where the mayor was deeply invested in this, the CTU was deeply invested in this, and yet it's coming down to the wire, and I think people weren't expecting the campaign by the real estate industry to be as strong and resonate with people as much as it did.
Well, and I don't even know if it was the real estate industry's messaging or just like raw confusion about this. Obviously, this was like stuck in legal limbo for several weeks. The language of the ballot initiative itself was really long, really confusing to some folks. And on the back of the ballot, nowhere did it say Bring Chicago Home. So I think there was a high amount of participation, but there also was a high amount of confusion. And the interesting part that the real estate folks kind of seized on was, one, taxes, yes, but two, trust in the mayor explicitly. Toward the end of the campaign, there were ads that said, how do you think Mayor Johnson's doing? How is he handling crime? How is he handling the migrant crisis? Do you really trust him to handle this big influx of money that this race would bring in? So I think it was kind of like a combination of confusion, that messaging. And Craig, I think you're right. At the beginning of this, we kind of thought, hey, if they message this right, that this will be a tax break for 93% of people, why would they vote no?
Well, and I found the mayor's response. It was again, it surprised me. He denounced the real estate folks who opposed it, which, of course, this was taking $100 million from some of the biggest buildings, and also from people, the small mom and pop folks who have a 12 flat or a 14 flat. I mean, that's going to sell. Many of those are going to sell for more than $1.5 million, and for them, this referendum represented a quadrupling of the real estate transfer tax. As many people pointed out, if you buy a rundown building, try to fix it up, or just try to keep it up, and then you sell it after a few years, this could wipe out a quadrupling of the transfer tax, could wipe out your profit.
Yeah, this was a this. Wasn't in the battle's not over, and I do also do want to talk about the what if, but let me remind everybody that you're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore. We're in the midst of a post-primary reporters roundtable with political analyst and veteran political reporter Mike Flannery and A.D. Quigg, who covers government and politics for the Chicago Tribune. First, I think they need to the messaging. If the forces for Bring Chicago Home are going to triumph at any point, they need to their messaging needs to take into account that this is involving taxes. Their
Property taxes, which is like so touchy.
Yes, this the messaging was about the problem. Their commercials were very heart-rending testimonials from people, and I've talked to at least one of the people in the commercials who had stories to tell, and there's no denying their stories tug at your heart. And yes, you want to do something about the problem. Nobody is against homelessness, the homeless people. The question was, did you address people's fears that they were going to suffer because of this? That's going to change probably. But here's the real question. What if the answer is no? What happens then? And, Mike, what do you?
The mayor said, Craig, he's gonna keep organizing, gonna come back. He says he's gonna get it. And he denounced the opposition using a strange word. He called the opposition cowardly for their focus on him, and the message, well, can you really trust Brandon Johnson with 100 million new tax dollars? I'm mystified by how that was cowardly.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure either. But AD, the mayor is even though he is not accepting defeat, he is also planning for what happens if he does have to find money elsewhere, right?
There's that, and then there's also whether he tries to raise the real estate transfer tax specifically again, either if they try to do a reworked referendum, maybe in November, maybe later than that, or if he tries to go down to Springfield, which is his other option, to have legislators down there raise the real estate transfer tax. He says, I'm going to keep fighting back, keep punching. But in the meantime, he's got a budget coming up with a lot of new costs. We've got a new police contract. We have the cost of this migrant crisis, our pensions, as always. He has to figure out some stuff relatively quickly. And part of that is going to be this new subcommittee on revenue that aldermen are putting together. They're weighing a number of options. How realistic any of them are, either politically or legislatively, is kind of an open question. Exactly what they land on, we don't know yet. But we could revisit some of the taxes that the mayor campaigned on. Jet fuel tax, head tax. We're not exactly sure where this is going, but we should have an answer potentially in the next month or so.
And interestingly, the mayor did suggest at his news conference after this past week's city council meeting, well, we also have that $1.25 billion bond issue that he intends to float. And he said that could make things a little easier too. Well, yeah, if you're talking about, you know, $1.2 billion, that's a lot of money. Could you shift 100 million of that from one thing to another? Maybe, but still, I know, Mike, you've been curious about some of the things that are being talked about, even with the task force that's supposedly coming up with ways to deal with pensions and revenue.
Well, the mayor has appointed 6th Ward Alderman Hall to chair this subcommittee on revenue that there have been stories about it, and there was a suggestion there. Franny Spielman at the Sun-Times, the veteran City Hall reporter, interviewed Alderman Hall and said that he was warming to some of the more controversial proposals, including putting a tax on assets of wealthy Chicagoans, would somehow be liquid cash type assets, stock holdings. You want to talk about a heck of a storm that might be stirred by that, and also a city income tax on everything over $100,000. Now, the mayor specifically and explicitly during his campaign last year said that he wasn't interested, or that, to be precise, that a city income tax was not part of his plan at that point. We're going to see, AD, when this report comes out in the next month or so, as you referenced.
Yeah, I wonder if they're not going to do what I've seen happen in a number of other reports, which is that you just throw it all out there.
Yeah.
And actually, we had an example of that in the transition team, where they threw a whole bunch of things out there, and then the mayor was able to say, no, that's not a plan. That's just...
this is a suggestion. We're just workshopping.
Blue sky. But I wonder if
they seem completely ignorant of how damaging this is to Chicago's economy, though. I mean, people hear this kind of talk and they take it seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're really not contemplating this sort of thing, my advice to Alderman Hall and the mayor and the rest of them is then zip your lip about it. It's scaring the heck out of the kind of taxpayers that the city needs.
I mean, we saw what happened to Governor Pritzker's graduated income tax proposal. I think some of the leftover hatred of that probably trickled over into Bring Chicago Home. Anything that says raising taxes, regardless of how it might impact you directly, you think about all the other knock-on effects it might have on rents or the economy or the commercial market here downtown in Chicago. I think people are aware that we're in a precarious recovery from COVID, and the idea of anything that could threaten that or exacerbate it or make that threat last longer, I think people are hesitant about.
Yeah, but while that progressive income tax referendum, AD, was crushed statewide by a wide margin, it actually got 71% yes in Chicago.
Right.
Craig, as you and I discussed election night on the air, I am shocked by the defeat of this real estate transfer tax increase.
Yeah, well, we will see what happens to that. But what the next big thing that's going to happen is really that we start gearing up to the presidential race. And I think the incumbents pretty much all won in the congressional races. So is there a challenge, though, that Donald Trump's shadow is still hovering over the Republican Party, which for years was fighting amongst itself, you know, within itself, about which segment of the party? Is it going to be the moderates or the right wing who are going to prevail? And now it looks like the right wing is prevailing, except in areas like DuPage County, where incumbent Democrats won and handily there. Well, they won handily in the general election, but the incumbents won their own primaries. So even challengers who are more conservative haven't had a real go of it. So Mike Boss beats Darren Bailey, although that race is close.
And that's a classic race. You talk about the influence of Trump, certainly up in the Chicago area. A Trump endorsement in many parts of the Chicago area would be the kiss of death. Down in Southern Illinois, where that Bost Darren Bailey contest took place, Craig, both of them, even when Trump endorsed Mike Bost, the incumbent, in a deal brokered by Speaker Mike Johnson down in D.C., Darren Bailey was still protesting his great love for Donald Trump. You know, neither one of them wanted to say a bad word about the former president.
Yeah, so we'll have to see how that plays out in Illinois. Illinois is a deep blue state and is not expected to help former President Trump at all. But nevertheless, the votes happen down the ballot, too, and who gets pulled into it. What do you see as the lessons that we take into the general election as we go through the primaries, Mike?
Well, I think we still, the Chicagoans, still have a big and busy political summer. We're going to get the Democratic National Convention here. You know, I think a lesson from the defeat of this real estate transfer tax referendum, which again came despite the progressive income tax getting 71% here. You know, I think it's certainly cause for Mayor Johnson's camp to be alarmed. They are trying to make at least a PR course correction. They've hired some new messaging people. You know, they've got some work cut out for them. You know, for the Democrats, Governor Pritzker, the mayor, they all have a lot riding on a smooth Democratic convention taking place here. Is this going to be a 1996 style Democratic convention, Craig, or a 1968 style Democratic convention? If you talk to some of the pro-Palestinian folks, just to give one example, people angry about what's happening in Gaza, they favor the 1968 model with lots of protesters, lots of demonstrations in the streets. You know, there are other forces, though, who want it to be calm and quiet.
AD, what are you looking for as we come through the coming months?
I was hoping for a kind of a clearer picture from Tuesday's results about whether Chicago was like fully embracing this progressive vision of Mayor Brandon Johnson and whether that was like our de facto MO from here on out. But Tuesday did not give us anything really solid to stand on. So I'm going to keep watching kind of the back and forth between more progressive and more moderate Democrats. I'll continue to watch how the mayor and the governor together handle the migrant crisis, whether that migrant crisis picks up, like Mike said, in advance of the DNC, and basically how folks get along and move forward here. DNC is like the main thing I'm watching for in terms of messaging. How do we handle protests and who's in charge of what?
And that's going to be the final word. I would like to thank A.D. Quigg of the Tribune and political analyst Mike Flannery for joining us. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. You can also find our podcast on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM. This was Illinois primary week, and for some contests, the most high-profile ones, it's not yet over. This weekend, we look back at what happened and ahead at what's next. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. Even if voter turnout is low, and maybe even because of it, there are things we can learn from even primary elections when the races that matter most have already been decided. We're going to look at some of the results and the outlook during this half hour with two stellar journalists. I am joined by political analyst Mike Flannery, most recently on the air at Fox 32, and he was our partner last Tuesday during our Election Central coverage. And we are joined by A.D. Quigg, who covers city and state government and politics for the Chicago Tribune and is one of my closest cohorts here at the at City Hall's press room. We are conducting this conversation via Zoom conferencing, and thanks to you both. Let's start with the state's attorney's race, because that was that race to replace Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox was the marquee matchup Tuesday. Clayton Harris III came in with the County Democratic Party's endorsement, with a campaigning County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, the party chair, and others. But former appellate judge Eileen O'Neill Burke came in with a lot of money and support from some conservatives and business people, and the race is still too close to call. As we are recording this on Friday, Mike Flannery, what's going on here?
Well, Eileen O'Neill Burke, Craig, as a number of people remarked on, did not really run a full-throated attack campaign against the incumbent, Kim Fox. And Ms. Fox, a couple of days after the election this past week, made the point that as close as it is, there's not a mandate to change her policies. I think she can make that argument. I think there's something to that argument. O'Neill Burke seemed to campaign arguing that, yeah, I'm going to keep some of the initiatives that Kim Fox has put in place, restorative justice and some other things, but I'm going to be a little bit tougher on gun crimes and some other offenses than she has been. And right now, as we record this, she's got a lead. I think I'd prefer to be her at this point than Clayton Harris III.
Indeed. But AD, Tony Preckwinkle was invested in this race. I've heard some complaints that maybe she wasn't as full-throated as she might have been. But from your perspective in covering the county, how do you see her influence and what this means?
It's given how close it is right now, it's kind of tough to call. And given that this was such a low turnout election, it's also kind of tough to call. It's hard to make kind of blanket assessments when like Democrats aren't as excited as they could be at the top of the ticket. Like Joe Biden's already decided, people weren't turning out as much. And the other thing we have to keep in mind, as much as we like talking about like the old days of the Cook County Democratic Party, it's not like a patronage system where members are getting rewards anymore and sent out door to door to go knock for people. Results in kind of a reward. The reason people are involved with the party now is to kind of be in the mix, get an endorsement, get a party-wide mailer sent out. And the benefit proposition is not the same as it was. So I think anyone would kind of struggle to force party folks to turn out. I would say Preckwinkle was as aggressive on the campaign trail as I've ever seen her for Clayton Harris. But this race did not get a ton of coverage. I can tell you, I was at like a lot of state's attorney candidate events where I was the only reporter there asking questions. And at a lot of those events, Tony Preckwinkle was there saying, Clayton Harris is our guy. He's important to continuing on this criminal justice reform movement that I am very invested in. I think she thinks of this as part of her lasting legacy. But yeah, the party is not what it used to be, where they can have hundreds of people out door knocking and getting a reward for it. So the math is a little bit different, but I am curious at the end of the day, when all the results are finally tallied, people see this as a referendum of her leadership and if she could have been more creative getting more people out to the polls, and if she could have done a better job fighting back against all of the funding that Eileen O'Neill Burke got.
Well, AD and Craig, if I could just jump in. I mean, one of the things that struck me when I watched this campaign unfold was Clayton Harris III and Tony Preckwinkle. I mean, they were at a news conference with Reverend Jesse Jackson a few days before the election, you know, and doing what they had been doing all, you know, for months, all but calling Eileen O'Neill Burke a racist based on a case that unfolded 30 years ago. it struck me that that just fell flat. I think, you know, that's kind of been that was really the heart of their attacks on her. And it didn't work.
I think that you're right about that, that it was because she could say it was 30 years ago and that she had never been cited as making a bad move. In fact, it was the lawyer for the young man who was sent to jail unjustly, who should have challenged the confession that he supposedly made. But I thought one of the other issues here is that we were dealing with two unknown quantities. Neither one of these people had ever run for elective office before. They were virtually unknown ahead of the campaign. So these campaigns were building them from scratch. And I think, AD, their positions, for all the rhetoric within the campaigns and the ads, they weren't all that far apart.
Right, right. And I will say Eileen O'Neill Burke ran for judge, but as we know, judge is not like a super sexy,
exactly,
high tension race. The other thing I think we have to keep in mind is that there was not an animating event like Laquan McDonald pushing people to the polls. That really got people invested and understanding what an important role the state's attorney's office has in prosecuting crime in general. So there was not like a certain level of excitement. The other thing is that neither of these candidates had as compelling of a story or presentation as Kim Fox did when she first came on the scene. I think Kim Fox was able to really leverage her personal story growing up in Cabrini, and serving as a prosecutor. Kind of, we saw Clayton Harris kind of allude to this, being like, I was a Black man prosecuting other Black men, and I also live in a neighborhood where I worry about violent crime. But it just didn't register in the same way that Kim did forever ago. And Craig, you're right, they were not far apart on a lot of issues. The main contention that Eileen O'Neill Burke made was, if you liked the job that Kim Fox is doing, don't vote for me. That was kind of the main thrust. And that she would be much more public about the importance of pushing back on crime and unilaterally asking for detention on a certain number of violent crimes. It was like slightly more tough on crime, but we want to keep a lot of the things that Kim wants to do. And the only animating issue from the other side, Mike, you're right, was that old case from 30 years ago. And to go back to Craig's comments, that boy never went to jail. He was sentenced to probation, which was essentially sent back to his family, which is another point Eileen O'Neill Burke made. This was not a wrongful conviction where someone spent decades in jail.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, there was a short sentence, and he served it within 5 years.
And we should, before we leave the county stuff, Tony Preckwinkle did manage to force out Circuit Court Clerk Iris Martinez by backing Mariana Spiropoulos, although you can also question whether the victory was Tony's or the fact that Mariana Spiropoulos was able to hugely bankroll her campaign all on her own, pretty much, and that she was a forceful campaigner all by herself.
And she had the backing of the new political army, the Chicago Teachers Union and their progressive allies, who on election day, as I understand it, covered thousands of precincts, certainly hundreds of precincts in the city and in the suburbs.
Yeah, there was bad blood between Iris Martinez and Tony Preckwinkle, going back to her Martinez's original election, when she also didn't have the party backing, but overcame it with a strong Latino vote, which, again, lack of excitement, low turnout, wasn't there.
Yeah, certainly the defeat of Martinez, and it was a large margin by which she was defeated, certainly calls into question her whole approach to the past 4 years. There She and Spiropoulos got into it, but there continue to be problems in that in that circuit court clerk's office. Not that that was a deciding factor in any way, but it's let's hope that Spiropoulos gets in there and fixes the computers, gets the documents available for the courts and for the lawyers and for members of the public who want the documents. You know, it continues to be a mess over there.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I'll say about the Martinez race is Iris Martinez also lost her own home ward in the committeeman's race. Where she's at on the Northwest side, Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez's kind of core progressive district, that whole area had a ton of activity that I think worked against Iris exactly where her base was.
And, but as we leave the Iris Martinez loss, I do want to say we should do remember where she started from as far as what that office was like. At the time that she took over, they used carbon paper. So the fact that they were actually using computers, admittedly with some glitches, that was a huge change.
Let's give her credit for that. I mean, Dorothy Brown for years had claimed that she was bringing it up to the Harvard Business School standards. That's just comical.
Yeah, they were still buying carbon paper. But let's talk about the other marquee race, and that was Bring Chicago Home. Again, hasn't been decided yet. We're still seeing votes come in, and we know we're going to see a bunch of votes come in after our taping. But I will tell you, when I looked at the numbers with 89%, I think of the votes, or 87 or 89% of the votes counted, and the it looks like they're far apart, because it's 53% no votes for Bring Chicago Home and 46%. Yes. However, in raw numbers, there were 22,500 votes between the no's and the yeses. That's not a lot, but that's what happens when you have low turnout, that there just aren't that many votes.
Mayor Johnson won with 28,000 votes, you know, with a much bigger turnout than we got the other day. You know, a win's a win, a loss is a loss.
Yeah, but still, this is again something where the mayor was deeply invested in this, the CTU was deeply invested in this, and yet it's coming down to the wire, and I think people weren't expecting the campaign by the real estate industry to be as strong and resonate with people as much as it did.
Well, and I don't even know if it was the real estate industry's messaging or just like raw confusion about this. Obviously, this was like stuck in legal limbo for several weeks. The language of the ballot initiative itself was really long, really confusing to some folks. And on the back of the ballot, nowhere did it say Bring Chicago Home. So I think there was a high amount of participation, but there also was a high amount of confusion. And the interesting part that the real estate folks kind of seized on was, one, taxes, yes, but two, trust in the mayor explicitly. Toward the end of the campaign, there were ads that said, how do you think Mayor Johnson's doing? How is he handling crime? How is he handling the migrant crisis? Do you really trust him to handle this big influx of money that this race would bring in? So I think it was kind of like a combination of confusion, that messaging. And Craig, I think you're right. At the beginning of this, we kind of thought, hey, if they message this right, that this will be a tax break for 93% of people, why would they vote no?
Well, and I found the mayor's response, it surprised me. He denounced the real estate folks who opposed it, which, of course, this was taking $100 million from some of the biggest buildings, and also from people, you know, the small mom and pop folks who have a 12 flat or a 14 flat. I mean, that's going to sell. Many of those are going to sell for more than $1.5 million. And for them, this referendum represented a quadrupling of the real estate transfer tax. as many people pointed out, you know, if you buy a rundown building, try to fix it up, or just try to keep it up, and then you sell it after a few years, this could wipe out a quadrupling of the transfer tax, could wipe out your profit.
Yeah, this was a the battle's not over, and I do want to talk about the what if, but let me remind everybody that you're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore. We're in the midst of a post-primary reporters roundtable with political analyst and veteran political reporter Mike Flannery and A.D. Quigg, who covers government and politics for the Chicago Tribune. First, I think they need to, the messaging, if the forces for Bring Chicago Home are going to triumph at any point, they need to, their messaging needs to take into account that this is involving taxes.
Property taxes, yes. Which is like so touchy.
Yes, this, the messaging was about the problem. Their commercials were very heart-rending testimonials from people, and I've talked to at least one of the people in the commercials who had stories to tell. And there's no denying their stories tug at your heart. And yes, you want to do something about the problem. Nobody is against homelessness, the homeless people. The question was, did you address people's fears that they were going to suffer because of this? That's going to change probably. But here's the real question. What if the answer is no? What happens then? And, you know, Mike, what do you
said? The mayor said, Craig, he's going to keep organizing, going to come back. He says he's going to get it. And he denounced the opposition using a strange word. He called the opposition cowardly for their focus on him, you know, and the message. Well, can you really trust Brandon Johnson with 100 million new tax dollars? I'm mystified by how that was cowardly.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure either. But the mayor is even though he is not accepting defeat, he is also planning for what happens if he does have to find money elsewhere. Right?
There's that, and then there's also whether he tries to raise the real estate transfer tax specifically again, either if they try to do a reworked referendum. Maybe in November, maybe later than that, or if he tries to go down to Springfield, which is his other option, to have legislators down there raise the real estate transfer tax. He says, I'm going to keep fighting back, keep punching. But in the meantime, he's got a budget coming up with a lot of new costs. We've got a new police contract. We have the cost of this migrant crisis, our pensions, as always. He has to figure out some stuff relatively quickly. And part of that is going to be this new subcommittee on revenue that aldermen are putting together. They're weighing a number of options. How realistic any of them are, either politically or legislatively, is kind of an open question. Exactly what they land on, we don't know yet. But we could revisit some of the taxes that the mayor campaigned on. Jet fuel tax, head tax. We're not exactly sure where this is going, but we should have an answer potentially in the next month or so.
And interestingly, the mayor did suggest at his news conference after this past week's city council meeting, well, we also have that $1.25 billion bond issue that he intends to float. And he said that could make things a little easier, too. Well, yeah, if you're talking about, you know, $1.2 billion, that's a lot of money. Could you shift 100 million of that from one thing to another? Maybe, but still, I know, Mike, you've been curious about some of the things that are being talked about, even with the task force that's supposedly coming up with ways to deal with pensions and revenue.
Well, the mayor has appointed 6th Ward Alderman Hall to chair this subcommittee on revenue There have been stories about it, and there was a suggestion there. Franny Spielman at the Sun-Times, the veteran City Hall reporter, interviewed Alderman Hall and said that he was warming to some of the more controversial proposals, including putting a tax on assets of wealthy Chicagoans, would somehow be liquid cash type assets, stock holdings. You want to talk about a heck of a storm that might be stirred by that, and also a city income tax on everything over 100,000. Now, the mayor specifically and explicitly during his campaign last year said that he wasn't interested, or that, to be precise, that a city income tax was not part of his plan at that point. We're going to see, AD, when this report comes out in the next month or so, as you referenced.
Yeah, I wonder if they're not going to do what I've seen happen in a number of other reports, which is that you just throw it all out there.
Yeah.
And actually, we had an example of that in the transition team, where they threw a whole bunch of things out there, and then the mayor was able to say, no, that's not a plan. That's just...
this is a suggestion. We're just workshopping.
Blue sky. But I wonder if
they seem completely ignorant of how damaging this is to Chicago's economy, though. I mean, people hear this kind of talk and they take it seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're really not contemplating this sort of thing, my advice to Alderman Hall and the mayor and the rest of them is then zip your lip about it. It's scaring the heck out of the kind of taxpayers that the city needs.
I mean, we saw what happened to Governor Pritzker's graduated income tax proposal. I think some of the leftover hatred of that probably trickled over into Bring Chicago Home. Anything that says raising taxes, regardless of how it might impact you directly, you think about all the other knock-on effects it might have on rents or the economy or the commercial market here downtown in Chicago. I think people are aware that we're in a precarious recovery from COVID, and the idea of anything that could threaten that or exacerbate it or make that threat last longer, I think people are hesitant about.
Yeah, but while that progressive income tax referendum, AD, was crushed statewide by a wide margin, it actually got 71% yes in Chicago.
Right.
I am... Craig, as you and I discussed election night on the air, I am shocked by the defeat of this real estate transfer tax increase.
Yeah, well, we will see what happens to that. But what the next big thing that's going to happen is really that we start gearing up to the presidential race. And I think the incumbents pretty much all won in the congressional races. So is there a challenge, though, that Donald Trump's shadow is still hovering over the Republican Party, which for years was fighting amongst within itself about which segment of the party? Is it going to be the moderates or the right wing who are going to prevail? And now it looks like the right wing is prevailing, except in areas like DuPage County, where incumbent Democrats won and handily there. Well, they won handily in the general election, but the incumbents won their own primaries. So even challengers who are more conservative haven't had a real go of it. So Mike Boss beats Darren Bailey, although that race is close.
And that's a classic race. You talk about the influence of Trump, certainly up in the Chicago area. A Trump endorsement in many parts of the Chicago area would be the kiss of death. Down in southern Illinois, where that Boss Darren Bailey contest took place, Craig, both of them, even when Trump endorsed Mike Boss, the incumbent, in a deal brokered by Speaker Mike Johnson down in D.C., Darren Bailey was still protesting his great love for Donald Trump. You know, neither one of them wanted to say a bad word about the former president.
Yeah, so we'll have to see how that plays out in Illinois. Illinois is a deep blue state and is not expected to help former President Trump at all. But nevertheless, the votes happen down the ballot too, and who gets pulled into it. What do you see as the lessons that we take into the general election as we go through the primaries, Mike?
Well, I think we still, the Chicagoans still have a big and busy political summer. We're going to get the Democratic National Convention here. You know, I think a lesson from the defeat of this real estate transfer tax referendum, which again came despite the progressive income tax getting 71% here. You know, I think it it's certainly cause for Mayor Johnson's camp to be alarmed. They are trying to make at least a PR course correction. They've hired some new messaging people. You know, they've got some work cut out for them. You know, for the Democrats, Governor Pritzker, the mayor, they all have a lot riding on a smooth Democratic convention taking place here. Is this going to be a 1996 style Democratic convention, Craig, or a 1968 style Democratic convention? If you talk to some of the pro-Palestinian folks, just to give one example, people angry about what's happening in Gaza, they favor the 1968 model with lots of protesters, lots of demonstrations in the streets. You know, there are other forces, though, who want it to be calm and quiet.
AD, what are you looking for as we come through the coming months?
I was hoping for a kind of a clearer picture from Tuesday's results about whether Chicago was like fully embracing this progressive vision of Mayor Brandon Johnson, and whether that was like our de facto MO from here on out. But Tuesday did not give us anything really solid to stand on. So I'm going to keep watching kind of the back and forth between more progressive and more moderate Democrats. I'll continue to watch how the mayor and the governor together handle the migrant crisis, whether that migrant crisis picks up, like Mike said, in advance of the DNC, and basically how folks get along and move forward here. DNC is like the main thing I'm watching for in terms of messaging. How do we handle protests and who's in charge of what?
And that's going to be the final word. I would like to thank A.D. Quigg of the Tribune and political analyst Mike Flannery for joining us. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. You can also find our podcast on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.